Hi, I'm Shanna Bennett, and I'm here with producer Talia Malay after a little bit of a hiatus, but we have some good things to discuss. Talia, lead our conversation.
Yes, gladly. Well, it's good to be back. We have a really exciting spotlight with the Higher Ed for All Coalition of Massachusetts, and very, very informative and just wonderful work that they're doing. Very inspiring, and hoping that what they're doing in Massachusetts just can be seen in other states, right? Other states pick on. No, that's not what you say. What's it pick on?
Like piggyback? Catch on.
I wish we could do Spanglish, because then it would be perfect for me. Yeah, but really excited. No, seriously, for that spotlight.
Yeah, me too. I think it's always good to highlight moments where we feel like we're achieving things, especially in like the national conversation about student debt. Sometimes it feels like we hit these roadblocks. So it's good to literally shine a spotlight on people that are moving the needle.
Yes.
And are accomplishing things. It just helps reinforce.
And this coalition, this group of people, they are achieving great things, and they are a wonderful example of what we can achieve as a group, as a movement, if we stick through the fight, you know, and not give up, which I think is a very important message to continue, especially when we're talking about the student loan debt cancellation or abolition. And yeah, I just wanted to point out to thank our listeners for letting us be on hiatus last month. We have been waiting on some really great things coming from the Debt Collective, another tool, next steps, if you will, that will allow us to continue our fight for full cancellation of student loan debt. We've had some unfortunate rulings and some setbacks, but the good people of the Debt Collective have come up with a tool to as of last night's meeting, because I went to the meeting, the Debt Collective has officially bombarded the Department of Education's email because this appeal that they generated.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm excited to learn more about it, because I've heard, you know, little bits here and there. And so I'm learning about it for the first time with our listeners. So yeah, please
perfect.
Share.
Perfect. Yeah. Bring people up to date. We have right now some dates that are really important for everyone to be aware of. As of September 1st, the interest rates are going to be turned back on our student loans. And then October 1st is when we will have to enter into repayment, right? There is this new tool the Department of Education rolled out with called SAVE, and it's a new income-driven repayment plan. And basically, the major thing that we can take away from that one is that if you apply for that and you qualify, your interest rates will not grow at all. They won't, they'll just stay as is. So your principal is not going to be growing. So we do, us, of course, and the Debt Collective recommends that if you can get on board with the SAVE plan, go ahead and do, and I'll explain why. So the tool that the Debt Collective came up with is called Biden Better Have My Money, and it's a student debt release tool. Now, last night I went to their meeting around this. It was one of many meetings that they're going to have. They will announce in a couple weeks when they're going to have the next meeting around this tool. So stay tuned for that. It'll be very important. Once we get the dates, I don't know if we'll be able to put them here because this will air already, but we'll put their website, of course, on the show notes. Basically, what the tool does, and let me give a quick historical account from what I learned in the meeting last night, is that Eleni Shermer, Eleni, if you hear this, I apologize for butchering your name, who is an incredible reporter, researcher, and just overall human being, wrote a piece in The New Yorker called The Aging Student Debtors of America, and she centers Betty Ann, who is basically an elder, and she took out 29 federal loans. And now in her later years, she was up to, The exact amount was $329,309.69.
I remember the story, startling.
Yeah, and then it just, it blew up, and everybody was like, how is this possible? So then Eleni, of course, was helping Betty Ann out and try to see, like, call it, talking to the Department of Education, doing research to see what the hell she could do for her. And she wrote a follow-up article. And in the article, she basically says that, you know, all she really needed to do was file this appeal, if you will, that explained why your debt needed to be compromised, settled, and released. So from that research, basically the debt collective and the groups of lawyers and strategists and everything came up with this specific tool. And what this specific tool is, mm-hmm. is that it's an appeal form. It'll take you through a bunch of questions. It'll have space for you to really let loose on how you're feeling, how this debt is unjust for you, what are the burdens, the list of burdens that are affecting you and how they're affecting you. Mm-hmm. And then what it does is that it generates this form that then puts in like all the necessary legal jargon.
Yeah, it's fascinating. No way.
And then this appeal gets emailed directly to the Department of Education. And you basically set your appeal for why you need your debt basically canceled, right? Compromised, settled, and released.
Nice.
And
nice.
Basically, that is, you know, what the debt collector is saying basically is, you know, this isn't necessarily promising cancellation. And it's a really great tool to let the Department of Education know you haven't done enough. Don't think that we've forgotten that you all promised us cancellation, trying to get away with not doing what you promised, and we're just not going to let you get away with it. So yeah, this is why the Department of Education, per Thomas, let them know that, you know, the debt collective is responsible, indirectly, if you will, for messing up their email.
Wow.
Because, I mean, yesterday, 2 days ago, it was the launch, and yeah, they had already like 5,000 something emails go through. So what they're trying to get to at least 100,000, you know, I mean, we have from now, at least until before the presidential election. So
that's so cool. I love that it fills in the legal jargon, the stuff that we, you know, as non-lawyer folks would need help with. That's awesome.
And it makes as well your own story, right? Because that's the point. So yeah, let's see what happens. I mean, it's fascinating. They did a great, great job. But I also do want to stress that this gets tied on to the greater work also of, or the continuous work, I should say, of the debt collective regarding the debt strike. You know, they've had many iterations of the debt strike. And the one that they're presenting here is, you know, to be debt striking just means that you're making 0 monthly payments, however that is. So if you're doing the SAVE plan and are able to get to 0, that's great. If you're in school and deferred, that's great. You know, as always, they say, don't put yourself in a situation where you're going to a vulnerable situation when it comes to this. But they're saying that using the 12-month on-ramp, which, again, is just a grace period, but they would need to put a fancy name to it, which starts October of 2023 and ends September of 2024. So that year is basically a one-year administrative forbearance. So the only thing that happens is that you're going to still accrue interest, but you're not going to capitalize on it. It won't go to your principal. And if you don't pay, you won't be reported to any credit bureau agency. You won't garnish, they won't garnish your wages. And yeah, basically, you know, you don't need to be enrolled in this. This grace period is for everyone, but this is one way that we can use that grace period to our advantage and strike if you want to. And so, yeah, they're also, you know, the debt collective is so good at answering all of our questions. So I would highly encourage people to go to the next meeting. I do believe it might be sometime next week. I'm not sure that they don't have the dates yet. So, but do check their website and join if you can.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, if we had a first-time listener that was tuning in, I'd want to just explain that the reason that we talk about this is because the debt can be so debilitating for so many people. And we strongly disagree with the idea of burdening people with the very extreme cost of education in this country. What we find is it further limits people going forward. It greatly affects their life, their lifestyle, their family, their choices. And it just doesn't make sense. It's a system that is incredibly broken. And we've seen that very clearly over the last couple of years. And so to kind of just restart payments without making true and sound like structural changes to this process is really unfortunate. So I'm really glad that the folks at the Debt Collective always have a plan. There's always some action to take. And so if you're interested in any of those things, by all means, tune into the Debt Collective. Check out our website. We'll have more information there. Thank you, Talia, for going to the meeting and getting all the deets for us. This is fascinating. 5,000 applications or appeals, I should say, or emails.
So basically, starting an appeal. Yeah. So they're saying here is my, I'm appealing this. So yeah, about 5,000. And that was last night. So I'm not sure. It's probably a lot more now. And we're going to try to have Debt Collective next month as well to talk a little bit more about this tool, which of course will be ongoing. And hopefully by next month, they can also tell us how the tool has been surviving in this period, you know? And yeah, I'm really excited. I know that Debt Collective always comes up with some very neat strategies. So I was looking forward to see what was the unveiling.
Also, what I like is that it's one thing to have a tool. It's one thing to organize around it, but to actually hear from the Department of Education, I guess through Thomas, that they're actually seeing the results of that is awesome.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much out there, from articles to research to books that really highlight how unjust these loans are. I mean, it just... we sound like a broken record. There's no need to really say it over and over again. There's just a lot of facts and evidence to support our claim, and really anything that we use to not just appeal, but to present our debt as something that needs to be completely canceled. You know, to bring back the wonderful spotlight that we're having in just a bit.
Yes.
When you really see how these institutions of higher learning, how they use the system in order to extract monies from students and putting students in these vulnerable situations where it's like, okay, well, I got accepted here and I really want to go, but for example, I'm forced to use the dorm. And well, you know, I'll just let the spotlight segment talk about everything. But yeah, it's just when you start peeling the system apart and really seeing how embedded the idea of extracting monies from the student body is just really screwed.
I agree. And I think what this Department of Education under Biden promised to do was to shine a light on some of these, you know, practices in this part of the, I don't know, financial world. And they've done that. I think they've done that. They've said, hey, we have issues, we're working on it. But at the end of the day, like, where are the big changes? Yes, they've rolled out some different payment plans. And yes, now we have this like year of onboarding or forbearance deferment, but I was really hoping for some bolder changes and some ones that we could all feel. It's been very segmented. You know, if you've gone to a certain, you know, for-profit school, maybe you have gotten some kind of forgiveness, but there's still a large group of us that have not really seen or felt any changes.
The truth is this administration hasn't done jack shit. And I mean, honestly, what's the point of another income-driven repayment plan when none have worked?
Right.
None have worked. Right. So what is the point?
I don't know.
You know, just giving us more of the same BS and just changing names around? It was Braxton that really pointed that out with the whole on-ramp. He's like, Oh, and for those that are probably new to this podcast, Braxton is also part of the Dead Collective. Wonderful mm-hmm. human being. He was the one that pointed out last night in the meeting that this on-ramp is just the grace period that a lot of people get when they once they graduate. So, you know, and in many ways, this idea of the grace period is not for our benefit. They're making it seem like it's for our benefit. It's for the administration's benefit, you know, to fix the administrative side of it, because it is going to be a cluster.
The volume. I mean, we're turning on payments for how many millions of people? It's going to be really. I think the stat was 1 in 5 accounts is going to have something wrong with it.
Yes.
So if you're listening and you have student debt, check your account, check your balance, check your information.
I applied for the SAVE plans because I graduated in 2021, so I haven't had to pay or anything like that. And I called Nelnet because that's who has my accounts now, because they emailed me to say like I was missing some sort of proof of whatever the fuck. And I called them, and when they told me your wait time is 80 minutes, I was like, I laughed so loud, like as if I was, I mean, I really did. I was just like, go screw yourself. And I just hung up. I'm like, wow, this is just ridiculous.
80 minutes. That's what people are saying. They don't have enough people. They've lost funding. We're going to end up in the same situation where errors end up with us being in more debt for longer periods of time. We're the ones that pay for that.
So another income-driven repayment plan is not the answer. We know what the answer is, and hopefully by messing up there, we can push back.
And I hope that they read every single appeal. Every single.
Well, they have to. You know, that's the whole point. So if they were short-staffed before, good luck now. I'm really happy to have been part of that first group.
Yeah, that's true. I gotta get on it. Yeah,
absolutely.
So switching gears to your spotlight, what a wonderful conversation. Yeah. I mean, it's incredibly uplifting. Because again, a lot of these folks, people don't realize, like, a lot of these folks are volunteers. A lot of these folks are people that are just passionate about this. And they continue to put in the work. And it ultimately benefits all of us. Because these can be case studies from state to state or from university to university.
Absolutely. And I'll just leave it at, you know, this is also the importance of the spotlight is to showcase that this conversation is still being had, the one about free higher education. That is also a conversation that is very intertwined with the conversation of canceling, abolishing student loan debt. And it's also a conversation or conversations that are very present within the Debt Collective as well. So, to really sit with the struggle and to really see that initiative is possible. It was possible at one point. We've had free education here before. And so to bring it back and to see how it unfolds, it is, I mean, I don't really like to use the word inspiring, but that's the one that's coming for me. So yeah, good conversation coming up.
Agreed.
Stay tuned for that.
For sure.
Welcome, everyone, to the spotlight segment of Matter of Life and Debt, where we highlight important people, projects, initiatives, anything that reminds us that a debt-free world is possible. Talia here, chatting today with Ian Rodewald, Joanna Gonzalez, Stephanie Marcotte, all part of the Higher Ed for All Coalition in Massachusetts. Friends, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Hey.
Seriously. Thank you. Thank you all for being here. We've had some technical difficulties to be expected with this Mercury retrograde, but we are doing it. Before we get into the conversation, I wanted to read this wonderful description of what the coalition is and what you do. This is in their website. The Higher Ed for All Coalition states that they are a coalition of students, educators, parents, union and business leaders, community supporters, public higher education faculty and staff and legislators who are organizing for a major investment in our public universities, colleges, and students. I was just talking before we started the recording that this is a really important conversation to be having right now, especially because those listeners that have been following us for a while know that we sit with the Debt Collective a lot. And one of the initiatives that goes hand in hand with the abolition of student loan debt is free college for all. And Massachusetts is really setting the stage for what that can look like. So why don't we start first by you all introducing yourselves?
Sure. So my name is Stephanie Marcotte. I live here in Massachusetts. I'm a higher ed organizer with the Massachusetts Teachers Association. Before that, I was an adjunct faculty member at Holyoke Community College here in Massachusetts for about 7 years. And I carry quite the burden of student loan debt. So this is an issue that is near and dear to my heart.
Hi, I'm Joanna Gonzalez. I'm a faculty member in the psychology department at Salem State University. And have only gotten involved in the fight against debt during the pandemic, which sort of revealed to us the problems that were happening on our campuses. And I started paying more attention. I'm part of a progressive caucus within the Massachusetts Teachers Association called the Educators for Democratic Union. And I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
I'm Ian Rodewalt. I'm the field organizer for the Western Mass Area Labor Federation. We're a coalition of more than 60 public and private sector unions in the four westernmost counties of Massachusetts, representing about 50,000 unionized workers in the region. And we've been organizing around the issue of student debt, labor for student debt relief for the past year and a half. And as Stephanie mentioned for herself, it's personal to me as well. My wife and I have about $130,000+ in student debt.
Thank you. Thank you for the work that you all do. Tell us a little bit about the coalition itself. Stephanie, if you want to start, we can circle around like that.
Yeah, sure. You know, so really this is a group of people who see public colleges and universities as a common public good. Mm-hmm. And we are interested in pushing to really offer high quality public higher education. And this is something that we have in Massachusetts, but really we need the additional funding and targeted investments to maintain that quality, but also to increase access. So equity is something that's really near and dear to the heart of this coalition. So like you read in our little description, you know, we are a statewide coalition that's growing of labor unions, educators, grassroots organizations, political organizations, policy research groups, more. We also have a whole subsection of business and civic leaders who really see that debt-free public higher ed is essential to the growing, you know, business and commerce of the state. So, you know, it's really exciting that we are able to kind of reach a lot of different industries and points of view and experiences that way. But the coalition itself is really rooted in four different pillars. One is recruiting and retaining high quality faculty and staff. So, you know, making sure that we are supporting the folks that are supporting our students. That includes addressing, you know, justice for adjuncts and, you know, a variety of other things like health insurance, retirement, debt-free public higher education that's, you know, addresses tuition fees, but also is looking at other barriers that students are facing and making sure that we are removing those barriers and providing funding. So transportation, food, housing, things of that nature, to really make sure that it's actually accessible to students. Increasing student supports overall, making sure that we have the advisors that we need on our campuses and that they don't have hundreds of students that they're serving. They really can build relationships. And last but not least, making sure that we have green and healthy buildings for workers and students without putting that burden on the backs of our students through debt.
I was fortunate enough to go to school to get my BFA decades ago for free in the 90s. And it wasn't like that early 90s, late 90s, 98. And there was free public university in the state where I studied. And they didn't have these, they didn't have it because they couldn't, you know, these sort of, I don't know, I wouldn't call them requirements. The requirements for you to like stay in the dorms, which I later found out in my master's, during my master's, that the undergrad, it was mandatory that they stay in the dorms. This was a different university that I went to. I didn't go to the same one. And that just like blew my mind. Because what if you don't want to stay in the dorms, you know? But that was a requirement. So just the way that money is funneled through these institutions and the way that the institutions, not funnel, but extract money from students is quite appalling.
Especially students who are working nearly full-time
yeah.
hours and have families.
Yep. Yes. Ian, Joanna, anything you want to add to?
Yeah, so we had a real reason to form this coalition because a year ago, well, in a few months, we passed a ballot initiative to have a millionaire's tax mm-hmm. where the money would go to public transportation and public education. So the voters, right, support that here in Massachusetts. But so now it's a tax on income over $1 million, 4%. And so, you know, you want to make sure that the money actually gets used in a way that's going to benefit students and workers. And so then we needed to form this coalition to create some legislation to guide the use of this new revenue. And that took a number of conversations to figure out, well, what does that platform look like? And we're working with legislators to craft the bills. And in the end, we're behind two bills that were submitted. The CHERISH Act, which does many of the things that Stephanie just spoke about, as well as a second bill, the debt-free college bill as well. And we see that this is, you know, in the short term, the coalition's got work to do. We want to pass these bills in this upcoming session. But we need to stick together for the long term because our ultimate goal is what you just described, free public college. And that's a long project. And yeah. it's not something that is going to happen without tremendous organizing and building support across, you know, lots of different constituencies. And so it's exciting to be part of the coalition and doing this work together.
Yeah, fascinating. And yeah, Ian emailed, before you say anything, pardon, Ian, send me was the budget on how these things are divided. And I was like, that's fantastic. I mean, just to also read how everything is going to be divided, which we'll talk more about what Ian sent. It has to do with the passage of the Fair Share Amendment. We'll get to that. But Ian, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, in terms of this amendment that we did pass that Joanna was just talking about, the Fair Share Amendment, really is historic, and it's the first in the country that does something like this, and it increases the annual income tax on any income above your first $1 million by 4%, and that only affects 20,000, about roughly 20,000 households in the whole state. So not even the top 1%, but like the top 0.06%, and this initiative has been years in the making. And prior to it, the tax rate was that people making that much money would be paying 6% income tax, and the rest of us would be paying roughly around 10% income tax. So the reason it's called the Fair Share Amendment is because we got the ultra rich to start paying their fair share in taxes. And it really begins to push back at the austerity narrative, at the austerity mindset of governing. And it provides us with such, well, in this budget that just finally passed in July has $1 billion in it for that just came from the Fair Share Amendment. And so my job here at the Area Labor Federation, I was the Western Mass regional organizer for the Fair Share campaign, and just knocking on the doors, one of the most common refrains from people we would talk to was being really excited about just taxing the rich, even before we got to what it was going to go to. And that wasn't just like an anecdotal thing. That was also in polling in the campaign. We found the number one thing in terms of interest was taxing the super wealthy.
And can you guys share a little bit about of that journey and how that was received? I mean, of course, the amendment was applied, and you know, now we're going to see how those monies in Massachusetts are going to be used. I love the transparency there. But before you got to this point, how was this coalition being received? You know, the proposal that you all were situating, how was that also being received? What, tell us a little bit of the journey before you got this big win. You arrived at this big win.
So I would say that the Massachusetts Teachers Association took a huge lead with support from the National Education Association. You know, we have over 110,000 members. And then if you think about all of our students, our families, you know, we have 29 campuses. So that is a large teachers union is positioned to be able to go out into the community and talk to a lot of people. I would say that there was actually a step before that, which was there was a big win for our K-12 system 2 years prior. And that was a legislative win, not a ballot initiative, but that provided funding for K-12. And that's been transformative. And I think the public seeing the good it can do was receptive to the message. So as Ian said, there was many years of work behind it. And the teachers union did a lot on the fair share amendment to make that pass.
Yeah. And, you know, the MTA was a partner in what's called the Raise Up Massachusetts Coalition, which is similar community groups, faith groups, labor unions focusing together. And there are a variety of different priorities that coalition had. And one of them was winning the fair share amendment. And so it was through that coalition and really doing the grassroots organizing and the education and the connection and community around it that really got those dominoes to move in the right direction. And it took, you know, people on the ground across the state to get that work done, you know, like Ian, like myself, like folks that were out there having these conversations, having those tough phone calls, reminding people to get out to vote. And that's similar to what we're doing here now with the Higher Ed for All Coalition, right? We won the fair share amendment through coalition work. And now it's time to make sure that higher ed gets its fair share through the Higher Ed for All Coalition.
Awesome. Yeah. And so this, the fair share amendment was at least 6 years in the process of this particular initiative. But I think over the decades, there've been at least five or six attempts to change the income tax and how it's formulated in the state. But one of the really exciting things after the election that we were saying to each other was that, you know, it's in the Constitution now. So you can't change that without doing another state amendment. Unfortunately, we sort of immediately needed to go into a defensive posture after winning it, because as soon as she came into office, our new governor proposed estate tax cuts and capital gains tax cuts, which was serves to shoot some of the wins from the fair share amendment in the foot, because the people who would most benefit from the estate tax cuts and the capital gains tax cuts are these people who would be paying the increase in the fair share amendment.
Yeah, of course. Well, I'll keep what I was going to say to myself and instead say that I do want to highlight that also looking in the budget that Ian, you sent me, that, yeah, the monies are not just also going for higher education. They're also going to primary, secondary schooling as well. And I think that that's fantastic. You all have mentioned the Cherish Act and the debt-free bill. Can you expand a little bit on that? And I know that there, as we were having technical difficulties, we had a wonderful announcement that came through. If you'd also like to share that, we can start with Stephanie again.
I mean, I'm happy to speak about Cherish and debt-free. You know, the four pillars I mentioned of the coalition really are the four pillars of the Cherish Act. The one thing I will say is that we have had a lot of positive movement when it comes to the Cherish Act. We have 107 legislative co-sponsors, which is amazing. And this is due to, you know, educators, staff, students going out and meeting with their legislators and having these meaningful conversations and telling their stories. Some of the kind of quick takeaways that come from Cherish: it creates a program that focuses on debt-free. It's an investment, additional funds per high-need student to expand supports. I mean, it addresses health retirement for adjunct faculty. There's a larger wage equity working conditions commission and kind of looking at larger staffing levels. So, you know, it's really what I consider a wall-to-wall piece of legislation. You know, how do we really show that public higher education is important in the Commonwealth? We have to make sure that we're kind of raising up all aspects that are there. And then the debt freeze focused specifically on the debt portion. So guaranteeing public higher education for all Massachusetts students, creating a grant program, making sure that folks are still eligible for Pell Grants. But again, it just honing in on that one component of Cherish and kind of expanding it.
Great. What is missing from the debt-free dialogue and how does the Cherish Act address them?
Well, one thing that is actually sort of Joanna's area of expertise that I don't think is talked about enough in the national student debt discourse is the way that the role that campus debt plays in student debt and foisting campus debt off onto students via fees. And so one in the budget, there is, how much is it? It's $50 million for deferred maintenance of physical buildings at institutions of higher education. And Joanna, I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about how campus debt functions.
Yeah. So, you know, when the campuses were originally created, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts built the buildings. They paid for the renovations, including not just the academic buildings, but what were then called the boarding halls. And when there was an explosion of students, right, in the after the war in the 60s and 70s, to try to finance some of the dorms, the Commonwealth started borrowing. But it wasn't the state of Massachusetts seeing out the loans. It was the campuses themselves to do the construction projects. And these are called revenue bonds. The revenue is actually student fees. So they get the bonds, and the backing of it is that you're going to have this many students with this level of occupancy in the dorms generating this amount of income. And if you can't make your debt payments, then there's intercept clauses, you know, that were built into a lot of these bond agreements that they could take your state appropriation, the money to pay your salaries, for instance. So it was a terrible move, and many, many states created similar systems. And like, for instance, the Dormitory Authority of New York is the largest public building authority in the, you know, lending authority in the country. It's a huge profitable business. So what happens is, I like Salem State where I work, we have about $250 million in capital debt. We will never pay it down because when we have a leaky roof, they just go out and borrow more money. It's endless. There's no end in sight. And we had a debt reveal. We did research on the different campuses to find out how it impacts students. And we learned, for instance, Salem State, the average student is paying $3,000. Actually, now it's more than $3,000. Every year in fees that goes just for debt service, for buildings. The Commonwealth has gave up on buildings. However, I will say the Cherish Act reverses that. It puts the responsibility on the Commonwealth to pay its bills, not just salaries and benefits, but to take care of the buildings in a way they once did. If it passes, eventually, what will happen is that students won't have to pay. I mean, you can just take a look and see how much you have to pay for room and board. But, you know, about a third of the student loans that students are taking out for are for these, for parking, for dining plans, for housing, for athletics. They even community colleges have like per student fees to pay for their building repairs. So what the Cherish Act does is it requires the Commonwealth to take a look at what needs to be done on the campuses and start to come up with a capital improvement plan that addresses it. As was mentioned, one that has green technologies. And there's also a debt relief fund language in there so that campuses can apply to have some of that existing debt that they own either paid off or taken over by the state. And actually, there's a couple of shining examples of this happening in other places in the country. About 2 years ago, the federal government sort of wiped out the capital debt at the historically Black colleges and universities. And when that happened, all of a sudden, the structural deficits that existed were gone. And the financial pressures were gone. You didn't have to run your college like a business any longer. You don't have to worry about whether the nursing program can produce profit or not, right? It doesn't matter. You do what you need to do to support the missions of your college. And another example actually is more recent. There was a merger of colleges in the Pennsylvania system. Penn State West got into trouble in large part because of the capital debt that they had. And when they merged the campuses, they did wipe out the historical legacy debt so that the campuses had a chance to survive.
This is fascinating stuff because in the push for your mission, right, you reveal how deep the extraction runs, you know, really. I mean, I had no clue about all of this stuff. Most people don't.
When we tell students where their money is going,
yeah,
it's going to Wall Street to pay for debt. And not only are they paying, you know, the colleges giving lots of interest money, right? Now the students are taking out loans and Wall Street gets like a double dipping here. It's so much extraction.
It's so infuriating, especially too when, what if you're one of those people that didn't have to stay at the dorms, you know, but you're still paying into these things? Or what if your student doesn't necessarily use the building? It's like, in many cases, you have to pay to use the building, to be in the building.
I will add that the students staying in the dorms, they are paying a greater proportion of it as an average. However, on our own campus, it's about $1,500.
And there's also a way that it is impacting workers on campus. At UMass Amherst, my alma mater, which I think when I was looking at the campus debt reveal, had the highest level of around 4,000 per student per year, and it's probably more than that now. But at my former union, GEO, Graduate Employee Organization, they have been pushing in their contract and they're in negotiations currently for a demand for no fees for employees. And that's because some of the workers in some departments have to actually pay fees to do the work that they're doing as TAs or research assistants, and that ties in with the campus debt.
Wow, incredible stuff, and how important your work is. Honestly, I think you sort of touched on this, but I'm wondering how you all see this incredible work that's being done in Massachusetts. How do you see that hopefully inspiring other states to do something similar?
I mean, you know, just to reiterate the wins that we just got from the Fair Share Funds, in addition to the additional money going for capital improvements, like Joanna mentioned, I mean, we have free community college for folks over the age of 25. We have free community college for nursing students. We have a big increase in the amount of scholarships. Plus, there's money here that's earmarked to start planning for free community college in the fall of 2025, period. I mean, these are huge steps in the right direction. And I think given, you know, the little federal relief for people who currently have debt, being able to minimize future debt for folks that are coming into this pipeline is essential work that we need to be doing. And part of that is really showcasing that public higher education is a public good. And in doing that, we should be investing our money and our tax revenue in these different programs. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you want a certificate, a vocational certificate, a degree, associate's, a bachelor's, you want to continue beyond that, that's your right. You have the right to an education.
One thing, we have a coalition called the Coalition Against Capital Debt. I put a plug in for that. It's just a group of educators who wants to pull back, resist the debt economy. And we've had about 24 debt reveals. And we go to campuses and we say, let's like take a look at the books. Let's see whether or not, you know, what's the cause of the austerity on your campus. 9 out of 10 times, the campuses were in debt over their heads. Like we looked at the West Virginia. Debt is a problem there. And yet, you know, nobody talks about it.
what we need to do is kick the bankers off of our boards of regents, off of our boards of trustees, and we need to populate it with, you know, community leaders and educators so we can start really thinking about how do we support the missions rather than trying to make the credit agencies like Moody's happy. And it's just reclaiming our colleges for the public good. Yes, I hope that our example in Massachusetts can inspire communities and workers in other states to do something similar.
And speaking of credit agencies, I know the Debt Collective has talked about how campuses that have active labor unions on them have lower credit from Moody's than campuses that don't have organized workers. And what I was going to say in terms of how Massachusetts can be an example for other states is that over the course of the campaign for the Fair Share Amendment, it was really exciting to see that, you know, people across the board were supportive of it. And so you'd be canvassing in a neighborhood and go up to knock on a door who might have fairly conservative yard signs supporting other conservative candidates. Then they'd be all on board for taxing the rich to pay for public services for the public good. And I think that message really is transferable to other states. And the no campaign, the campaign against us that we were fighting against was that the majority of that was funded by 5 millionaires and 2 billionaires. And we fought against that with this coalition of organized labor, community groups, and faith-based organizations.
Yeah, I mean, go figure. People wanting their rights is something that is popular. I mean, I can keep you here for a much longer time than what we are assigned. This is so fascinating. I'm actually, you can't see me here, but I'm like very excited and like, oh my gosh, I'm like, I'm going to move to Massachusetts. I'm gonna join you guys.
Well, just make sure that you move in time for our hearing day on September 18th.
Absolutely. Is there anything around this conversation in closing that you would like to just add before we do plugins and, you know, dates and all that?
One thing I've been thinking about in terms of the movement to cancel student debt, to abolish student debt, is what can that movement learn from the success of something like the Fair Share Amendment, and how can the campaign to cancel student debt transfer to, you know, door-to-door conversations with neighbors, conversations with community members, and how can it sort of scale up from where it is now? I mean, everyone in the movement for student debt cancellation is doing as much as they can. And I guess I'm wondering how do we sort of reach persuadables who are on the fence about the issue of student debt or who aren't personally impacted by student debt? And perhaps a campaign such as Fair Share Amendment that really engages the community might be something that could be on the horizon.
I mean, there are conversations that are not exclusive from the other. I mean, they really are tied and can benefit from doing work together. Absolutely. Anything else? Yeah.
The one thing I did want to mention about the coalition and the Cherish Act specifically, you know, this is a unique piece of legislation because not only is it prioritizing debt-free public higher education, which in itself is huge, and not just tuition fees, the wraparound services, really breaking down those walls and barriers that students face. But it's also like empowering workers, improving wages and working conditions, and making sure that everybody is working and learning in safe, green, sustainable buildings that are not funded on the backs of students. Making sure that, you know, our high quality public higher education is fully staffed. And, you know, we have educators and staff of color who are here to support our students. That we have, you know, the variety of different resources that folks might need on campus, that we're meeting the needs of students who are first generation, immigrants, refugees, workers. Really, public higher education is a pillar for accessibility, and we're investing in that with Cherish.
Plugins. Is there anything that you would like for our listeners to know? Dates?
Sure. This isn't necessarily a plug-in, but just echoing everything that Stephanie just said. Also, we've been focusing on the higher ed aspect of the Fair Share Amendment, and that in terms of the budget this year, that is $523 million that goes to public education, not just higher education. But it also goes to, there's about $500 million that goes to infrastructure, public transportation, municipal roads and bridges. You know, we have more than 600, I think, structurally deficient bridges in the state that this will go to. It goes to early education and care and K through 12 education. And there's, where is it? There's dollars that goes for reimbursing school districts for free school lunch for every student. And I know the Debt Collective has been working on the issue of lunch, student lunch debt, which is absolutely abominable. And so just highlighting all the wins that are in this budget, even beyond higher ed, that do impact us all as a community in terms of public goods for public investment in the public good.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, these are all public goods that we're investing in. And when many of our students are also parents and workers, this is benefiting them and their ability to focus on their studies. So in many ways, like even if something is listed as, you know, being funded by Fair Share, like bridges, those are the bridges that our workers and our students are driving on. Those are the buses they're relying on. You know, they need safe, high quality childcare and public schools for their children to go to. And really, this is investing in, you know, our neighbors. So I think it's really important. And the best way for our community, regardless of their educators or staff or different, you know, individuals, anyone who's interested in making sure that higher ed gets its fair share, really should join us on September 18th at the State House in Boston in Gardner Auditorium. It fits like 500 people. So please bring a friend. And both the CHERISH Act and the debt-free bill will be heard on that day. And folks can learn more by, you know, following us online or on Facebook at Higher Ed for All.
Awesome. And is there a website? We'll be plugging in all this information on the show notes.
So folks can follow the Massachusetts Higher Ed for All at mahigheredforall.org or on Facebook at mahigheredforall.
Awesome. 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 Ian, Stephanie, and Joanna, thank you. Thank you so much, first of all, for the work that you all do for the coalition and in general. And thank you for spending time with us on our spotlight section. This is really exciting, and this is a very big deal. And I really hope that it serves as an inspiration for many more states to follow this because it is possible.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much, my friends, and come back. That was a really great segment. I learned so much.
It really was. I'm glad that they were available to hop on the show and let us shine a spotlight on what they're doing, because it's really alarming how like murky the underbelly of the student debt world is. I'm glad that they're, you know, they've pushed for this fair passage amendment. I'm glad that the fruits of their labor, again, you know, benefit all of us, even if it's just in Massachusetts. I mean, it's fabulous.
Yeah, because they set the example. And the fair passage amendment, which is an amendment to the Constitution, I love that they, you know, tax the wealthy. Period. And this is what we could do, you know, and we'll be able to put the budget that Ian sent to us. But it's great because it's obviously not just for the higher ed that these monies are going to go to. It's also going to go to primary, secondary schooling. It's also going to transportation. I mean, it's not just look at what we can do for higher education, but look what we can do when we pay our fair taxes. A fair share of taxes. So that, yeah, to see all of this in action, and of course to hear the stories of solidarity and coalition building, it's great, especially when it comes from the teachers unions. I mean, there's just so much of what they're doing we're starting to see across the nation already, you know, people really coming together in these ways and putting out their fight and saying, we're not going to stop until we get what we want.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And also extra emphasis on this free college for people. I mean, hello, that's awesome. That's life-changing for a lot of people. Side note, I know that one of the hot topics of the summer was the Taylor Swift concerts that are still happening. But, you know, she gave these bonuses to truck drivers on her tour, and she gave them $100,000, I guess, each. And one of the truck drivers was saying that they're used to receiving like $5,000 or $10,000, you know, on top of what they're normally paid. But he was saying that $100,000 is a life-changing amount of money. And that's what these people are doing by offering free college to people. Because like, that's about how much sometimes an education can be in this country. It's life-changing.
Yeah, it's how much my master's cost me. $100,000 was my, and I wasn't living on the dorm or anything like that. I mean, that was just because that's how much it costs to go to school. Yeah. Yeah.
It's wild. It is wild.
So make sure that if you all are in the Massachusetts area, go to their September 18th town hall and join them for their coalition building.
And for more information on the Higher Ed for All Coalition, check out our website. We'll have more information there as well.
We'll also be able to plug in the budget sheet that Ian gave us. A lot of good information. Yeah.
Nice. Nice. Anything else?
So yeah, I know that next week, as of this recording, they will probably have another meeting around the tool. Biden better have my money. But stay tuned to their website for that. They haven't rolled out any dates. Or if you are part of their mailing list, they will be sending out email for that.
Awesome.
Oh, it's so good to talk to you again and good to sit here and to talk to our listeners. I hope that it was informative.
I know. We're back from our hiatus. So we'll see you guys next month.
Ciao.
Bye. Love you.
Love you, boo.
If you like this episode of Matter of Life and Debt, subscribe and share it with a friend. It really helps people discover us. Matter of Life and Debt is hosted by me, Shanna Bennett, and created by Nikki Nolan. It is produced by Emma Klauber, Nikki Nolan, Talia Malay, and Shanna Bennett. It is edited by Talia Malay and Nikki Nolan. Transcripts and social media writing is done by Emma Klauber. Our theme music was created by F.A. Achman. Visit our website, matteroflifeanddebt.com, where you can listen to more episodes, access transcripts, and get additional context for the subjects you just heard about. Absolutely for free. The website again, matteroflifeanddebt.com. Thanks again for listening.